Circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
Most peculiar, Mama. Roll.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
There are those detractors who say there's not much happening as far as UFOs are concerned, and this program and its guests beg to differ, as you'll hear. The UFO updates list also belies the detractors. Your access lets you both hear and see a fair bit of what many consider to be real, and what isn't real in the ufological sense SDI and UFO updates tend to ignore. Contributing to our reality this time are a pair of Chris's, Ritkowski of the 2008 Canadian UFO survey results, and Shag Harbor investigator author Chris Stiles, who make up two-thirds of this all-Canadian edition of Strange Days Indeed. And the remaining third is commentator-observer Dave Berlock.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Berlock.
There has been some considerable posting to the UFO updates list regarding the German Air Force chasing a UFO that was flittering around Germany last month. And as I had read the various news stories that were posted about this event, it dawned on me that it falls into the same category as the UFO that was chased in Kent, UK, and the UFO that was chased by F-16s in Stephenville, Texas, USA. Basically, any UFO that is chased by any military or police aircraft now becomes big news. It's reported very seriously, and it kind of makes me wonder, why is it that these reports suddenly seem to be either more believable or more serious than the hundreds of UFOs that have been chased by military aircraft starting as early as the 1950s. Now, it appears to me that we're giving more credibility to these UFOs that are spotted and chased by military and police aircraft than we have in the past. And perhaps it's because now our military and police organizations are finding it more difficult to put things under wraps. Everyone and their dogs have cell phones with built-in cameras, and people, including those involved in some of these chases, are coming forward a lot more readily. Besides, if you try and hide it, a little digging actually brings out things that even the USAF cannot hide, in essence, making them have to change their story to fit the facts. They haven't done that before, have they? So, the question is, are there suddenly more UFOs starting to be picked up and chased by military or police aircraft? Or if we're hearing more about them because we're living in more of a communication-friendly society. And it's not only the people witnessing the event, but the spillover from the radio chatter between radar stations and the pursuing aircraft are being picked up by those that are not actually involved in it. It appears that the mainstream media is paying more attention to incidents involving UFOs and military or police pursuits of these unidentified objects. And that might be because more and more people are coming forth about incidents that have taken place in countries outside the USA and Canada. Iraq, Iran, England, Australia, Brazil, just to name a few. And it gets even deeper because in some cases, it did not merely involve just chasing these craft. There were incidents where the military aircraft attempted to attack the object they were pursuing. Now, we're getting more and more reports of these encounters, but we're also getting more reports between commercial aircraft as well as the military and police. And with the mainstream media paying more attention to incidents like this, it simply means that it's only a matter of time before there is a public outcry demanding to know what is going on in the air that requires the intervention of military and or police aircraft. It becomes a rather easy formula if you follow the logic. Commercial aircraft do not change course or make reports about things they see in their airspace either visually or with the aid of radar. Military and police aircraft are not dispatched to chase lights or Venus or the moon, and although they can appear large in our skies, Venus and the moon do not register on radar. So, if commercial, military, and police are chasing or even being chased by things they cannot identify in our skies, it is only logical that these unidentified things are actually posing some kind of danger. Our governments are responsible to us citizens to keep us safe. And that includes keeping our airspace safe so we can travel peacefully from place to place. If there are strange objects in our airspace, and if they are getting dangerously close to our commercial, military, and police aircraft, then the question is really not will they ever collide with our aircraft. The question is when will one of them collide with one of our aircraft. Now, supposedly collisions have already occurred, but the military and governments involved were actually capable of keeping things quiet because back then they could control the flow of communications. It is becoming increasingly evident that communications really are no longer controllable by the government or the military. So when the inevitability of a collision occurs now, there is going to be an outcry to tell us exactly what caused that loss of life. You know, I really would hope that the governments would try and inform us about the danger posed by these strange UFOs in our skies before there is a loss of human life. But sadly, I think it's going to take the loss of a passenger aircraft to get our governments to give up what they know. But that's just my take.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
An excellent take, David.
Well, thank you. It annoys me. You don't have commercial aircraft, you don't have military aircraft, you don't have police aircraft doing all of these things on a whim or as a joke. There's something up there. Tell us about it before it becomes too late.
Dream on. It really is puzzling as to why they don't want to fess up to what it is that they are doing.
Yeah, and even when they get caught, with Stephenville, it was a situation they turned around and they went, oh, no, we don't have anything up in the air. We didn't have anything up in the air that night. Guys, we have pictures.
And multiple witness accounts.
Yeah, and a bunch of people that say they saw F-16s.
Yep.
And they're going, oh, well, we had a training mission up there.
Oh, yeah, we forgot.
We forgot about that one. Yeah. Okay, cool. You're the guys that are responsible to know what's up there, right? Yeah, you forgot about that little training mission. Yeah, cool.
And there have been so many reports of near misses by various types of aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Again, near misses by a lot of commercial aircraft. And not only that, but, I mean, we even get reports from military in other countries that are saying, okay, I was looking at this thing, I went to arm my missiles and launch, and it wouldn't let me. They were going to shoot it, and they couldn't. I don't know. There's not a whole bunch of atmospheric phenomenon out there that I know of that can disable the military attack capability of any of the jets of any country out there that I know of. If the U.S. or Canada had that capability in their air forces, they'd be really happy about that. Okay, let's go up into the air. If we get into a shooting war with these guys, we flip a switch and now they can't shoot at us. Nice.
I'm just looking at the results of my Google search for aircraft UFO near misses.
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking at results of 1 to 10 of about 50,400 Google results.
Oh, I know. It's nuts. We have a lot of stuff up in the sky. There is no question about that. And sooner or later, it's got to happen. There are some people that are claiming, you know, some of the stuff that's happened in the past, there have been the mysterious aircraft that have gone down, that we've been fed little results that you sort of go, excuse me, that doesn't sound quite right. The flight over Long Island, basically there was a lot of concern because they were saying that there were missile trails. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, we may have already had it. They may have already been able to cover it up. But it's now getting to the point where, sorry guys, you're not going to be able to cover it up anymore. There are people out there that if they see something and they've got their cell phone with them, whoop, click.
Mm-hmm.
It's a done deal.
Well, the problem with cell phones is that the images aren't very good. What I found interesting, just to move away, a recent report, and I don't know if you checked it out, but there is a video out there of this ball of light that comes down on a highway down in South America with all kinds of people standing around. And it comes down onto the road and is in front of a vehicle that's stopped off to the side.
Oh, I didn't see that. I will go take a look.
Well, you've been a busy guy teaching and all.
This is true.
To go back to the near misses, when you look at NARCAP, the National Aviation Reporting Center for Aerial Phenomena, they have stopped calling objects that have near misses UFOs, and they're now calling them UAP, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena.
Yes, yeah.
And they encourage reports on their website. And I think the reason they stopped calling them UFOs was to make it easier for pilots and air traffic controllers to report.
Yeah, because as soon as they turn around and go, do you want to report a UFO?
No.
He immediately gets into the, do I want to be flying next week?
Yeah. Well, the mystery continues, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. And it's driving me crazy because I know that we are going to get into one of these situations, and it's going to be pretty dramatic.
The extension of that drama is the denial of what collided with the aircraft.
Oh, yeah. It'll be a situation, I can see it happening, where there's going to be no doubt that something collided with the aircraft. It'll be interesting to see if they manage to get it covered up. It was a small Cessna or something like that, and then show us evidence like they showed us the weather balloon a long time ago. Oh, yeah, this was a weather balloon. Here you go.
We shall see what we shall see, shall we not?
It's true.
Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you.
And as always, an interesting take, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Bye, Dave.
Bye-bye.
Well, I don't need you hanging around my door. Show. I ain't gonna drink your dirty water no more. Dirty water. Now what's that for? Dirty water. I ain't drinking no more.
I have talked much on this program over the years about Shag Harbor with Don Ledger and most recently with Mike McDonald, and also in the past with Chris Stiles. It's been a few years, I think, since Chris Stiles was here. Chris, along with Don Ledger, wrote Dark Object, the Shag Harbor UFO. And since Mike McDonald had suggested that Chris had dug out some more interesting information on the Shag Harbor incident, let us head out to the East Coast and have Chris Stiles join us. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Errol. I'm so
a pleasure to be here.
And it's good to have you here.
It's been a couple of years, as you say.
And I think you and I were both in Mike McDonald's two-parter documentary.
Yeah, I've been in a few of them with him, and I think that was Northern Lights, if I remember.
Northern
right.
Lights, right.
Yes.
And, of course, both you and Don were in the Shag Harbor UFO doc as well that Mike produced and directed.
Yes, and more recently there was another U.S. feature there called Canada's Roswell, which has run a few times on the History Channel here.
Can we just very briefly, for those listeners who haven't a clue about what Shag Harbor is all about, although that would surprise me, if we can just in a nutshell touch on what happened at Shag Harbor back then.
Okay, just to give a brief overview of how it all began, we're talking back in Canada's centennial year, October the 4th, 1967, and what happened was that around 11:20 p.m. was a clear, moonless night, perfect visibility, something we rarely have here in Nova Scotia. And people noticed that there was a set of flashing lights that flew in first from an easterly direction out of the Gulf of Maine, and they hovered for a time over the Shag Harbor area. They were different than normal conventional aircraft lights in that there was a sequence of four that flashed one, two, three, four, and then all together. They hovered there, like I say, over the Shag Harbor area for several minutes, then tilted to an angle, descended rapidly to the water surface, struck, producing the sound of an explosion and a bright flash. Seven people from different vantage points immediately contacted the nearby RCMP depot in Barrington Passage, and two cruisers came from two different directions and responded. And when the RCMP arrived on the scene, the UFO was seen still to be floating on the water. It sank, unfortunately, before they could be reached in local fishing boats, and a search began that went on until 3 a.m. in the morning. The Coast Guard joined that from nearby Clark's Harbor, the life-saving station, and it resumed again at first light. Eventually, what happened is word of the sighting and of the subsequent events reached Canadian Forces headquarters in Ottawa, and they ordered Maritime Command to conduct an underwater search, which went on for 5 days. After 5 days, it was terminated, claiming nil results. This all happened quite openly. The community watched it. There was CBC coverage, and it became a line story through newspapers around the world, even creating a headline in the conservative Halifax Herald, which looks more like something you'd see in the National Enquirer. It's interesting that at the termination of search, DND officials claimed that they didn't know what they were looking for. They were convinced that indeed something had crashed into the water there. There was no incoming space junk, no missing aircraft. They simply claimed no results, but all agreed that something indeed had gone into the water. There were many witnesses, and of course, the RCMP could be considered three professional witnesses who saw it.
Did the story stop there, or was there further investigation?
Well, incidents that night were just the tip of the iceberg. Researchers have referred to this night as the night of the UFOs, because there were sightings all over eastern Canada, but especially so in Nova Scotia and off the coast. There were just numerous reports from ships, aircraft flying over, etc. But what did happen is this started an ongoing interest in the phenomena that resulted in lots of speculation within the community, within the UFO community too. And at the official termination of search, there was still an ongoing investigation. Police were still knocking on doors, re-interviewing witnesses. People were coming forward with theories. And, of course, other sightings were started to be sift through. What we know nowadays in retrospect is there's so much more to this, like the old adage, the Shag Harbor incident, what happened, the events locally in the village that night of October 4th, were just the tip of an iceberg. There were many connected sightings, some by geography, some by time, some probably by actual circumstances, but eventually this thing slipped out of the headlines and into the dustbin of history, and I think if it happened somewhere else, there would have been much more word about it. Of course, this was a busy time in the phenomena, so you're back in what some people call the golden age, but it wasn't every day then. And something else that people forget is that in 1967, Roswell was an unknown commodity. It had come and gone in 47, and it really wasn't an influence. This was a time when people within the community thought that UFOs didn't crash, and many researchers would have scoffed at the suggestion. It wasn't the popular idea within our culture that it is today, dredged up in science fiction, speculation, whatever.
There were reports at the time that this thing had left a yellow foam on the water.
That's correct. That's one of the many details. When it struck that night, before it submerged, the distance it left between what I would call the initial impact site and the last known surface position, before it submerged or disappeared, would probably stretch half a mile. And there was a dense trail of yellow foam which sparkled. And it would have measured, of course, the half-mile distance it traveled on the surface at a width of 80 feet, which is an estimate made by some of the men who literally sailed through it in their Cape boats that night before the Coast Guard arrived. And this at some time, eventually, the strip of dense yellow foam dispersed in the ebbing tide, which was going out to sea at the time. But all agreed, men who knew the local conditions well, well-respected fishermen, that this was not normal tidal foam or anything they'd seen before, and it was assumed it was something laid down by the crafts skipping across the water there. We also have another interesting detail from that night. You know, there's just so much. Not all of it gets passed on in the many documentary treatments and rehashings, but one of the details I find quite interesting is we have a sense of the vertical relief of the thing. In the air, all the witnesses agreed the number that always comes up is that this thing was at least 60 feet across that held the four flashing lights. And when it hit the water, it was actually observed on the surface by Constable Ron Pond, one of the three RCMP officers. And while he looked at it through his field glasses, it passed between him and a well-known local feature called the Budget Buoy, which is a large anchored buoy that sits 8 feet out of the water. And when the UFO passed between the buoy and the RCMP officer, it totally obscured the buoy. So that means it's had at least 8 feet out of the water. Now, that does give us that detail. I should also remind your listeners, while it was on the water, it appeared very different than in the air. It no longer featured four flashing lights, but appeared as sort of a dome, like a pale yellow glow, just a single sort of diffuse light, and to the point where it extinguished, submerged, disappeared, whatever.
Did any of the guys who observed the 80-foot-wide yellow foam, was there any discussion about an odor from it?
Well, yeah, again, depending on which witness you talk to, some claim that it had a slight sulfurous odor, some say it had no odor. All tend to agree that it had a sort of sparkle to it and a definite yellow hue to it, you know, as far as the color went. There was an attempt by one local fisherman there, Norm Smith, to retrieve a sample in a very fine dip net, but he tried that a couple times and it would just simply disperse or kind of evaporate within the net, leaving no trace.
Pity he didn't have a bucket with him, huh?
You have to bear in mind, too, that when this was occurring, what was on the mind mostly of these men was the possibility of survivors.
Mm-hmm.
Those who hadn't been a witness to it were called at home and simply told by the RCMP that they thought a plane had crashed into the Sound, which is the local name for the Shag Harbor waterway there. The thing is, concerns ran for survivors. They didn't know what they were dealing with, and it was kind of the whole aggregate of observation of the officers, the local witnesses, and that eventually it was considered that possibly this was a UFO event, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting, and one of the unique features of the case, of course, is that the people who all reported, nobody reported a UFO. The first seven people who called that night called simply to say they thought that a small airplane or perhaps lights had been seen going into the Shag Harbor. No one actually reported the UFO. It was the authorities that first used that term.
Yeah, the reason that I asked about the smell was that, as you're probably aware, there have been many reports of a sulfurous smell after an object has been seen either on the ground or even in the air. And mm-hmm. there have even been reports of people who claim to have been taken by a UFO coming back covered in some sort of yellow fluid that also smelt of sulfur.
Well, that was very much a feature of the case. Like I say, certainly several witnesses claimed to have smelled the odor, but on the other hand, I just bear in mind that others claimed they had no odor, but detection and interpretation of odors can be a very personal thing and vary greatly, as we know. But there were certainly several witnesses did claim a sulfurous odor to it that night.
Subsequent to that night, were there any military involved in that area?
Well, yeah, things happened very quickly. Within the hour, even, a Labrador-style helicopter came that had been stationed temporarily at the nearby Backrow radar base to do a quick flyover. You must understand, too, that where this happened in Shag Harbor, it was very near two very important military bases at the time. One was Canadian Forces Station Barrington at Backwell, which was a NORAD radar facility. It was that end of the Pine Tree Line. You know, people are all familiar with the Dew Line, but there's also a Mid-Canada Line and a Pine Tree Line. That base, which was only like 15, 20 miles away as the crow flies, would be very near the impact site. And not far from that was Canadian Forces Station Shelburne. And at the time, many men have told me that was Canada's most secretive base. In fact, its purpose wasn't even known by the public then. Shelburne was the coordination center for submarine detection in the Atlantic. And it was, like the other NORAD facility, it was 50% Canadian staff, 50% U.S. under arrangement with NORAD. Mm-hmm. In fact, when those bases first opened, they were entirely American personnel and would have flown Old Glory only. At the time of the Shag Harbor incident, they were a shared thing under NORAD. So they were very important bases. And they were both within a half hour's drive of the impact site. And both became involved for two different reasons. There was a lot of checking with the radar base, who claimed publicly, and it seems to be the case, that there was no radar detection when the UFO was in the air. And, of course, after it hit the water, sonar data from things like the SOTA system and the MAD grid and all these things where they had hydrophone microphones, the entire Atlantic Ocean came into play for any underwater movement. So they were key in it, but like I say, there was actually a helicopter dispatch that did a quick flyover, too. So they were all quite involved.
Were there any reports out of either of those military bases?
Well, there was no official press releases from the bases. They were mentioned in some of the early coverage in the weekly newspapers of the area, which had just gone to press that night. But the search, the military involvement, was coordinated from two places, mostly from Halifax and Ottawa. And the reason is that here's the sequence of events. After these things were reported and investigated by the local RCMP and by the Coast Guard from the life station, of course, the Coast Guard filed a report with the Rescue Coordination Center in Halifax. The initial checking and concern was, were there missing aircraft? Was there incoming space junk, whatever? And, of course, it was quickly realized that no airplanes were down, none were missing, or not even overdue. So what happened was by morning, when they came back out at first light to resume the on-site search, this information was forwarded through the Rescue Coordination Center to Canadian Forces Headquarters in Ottawa, where it fell upon the desk of Squadron Leader William Bain, who was one of a couple majors with what's known as the Air Desk. In 1967, that was the division of the RCAF, the Royal Canadian Air Force, that dealt with UFO investigations, and it became their baby. And when they looked at the data, and the quality, of course, the amount of witnesses and the fact that RCMP had borne witness to these events, too, it was decided very quickly to call Maritime Command in Halifax and order an underwater search. So the two places where this were being coordinated from were Ottawa and Halifax, right? However, before they got in the act, there was already U.S. involvement. We know that now, and that's something that hasn't been quite focused upon enough. Because we do know that there was a carrier group doing practice for Vietnam out in the Gulf of Maine. They sent a jet to do air photo reconnaissance in the area. They knew something had happened. And a short while later, a SAC refueling mission flew over and tried to just check it out, too, from high altitude. Things happened very quickly, but the main centers of coordination for this were Ottawa and Halifax.
Let's leap forward a bit from 1967. You didn't give up on trying to figure out what went down in the water there in Shag Harbor.
No.
Have you come across anybody who worked at either of those military bases?
Well, yes, I've interviewed many people there. Perhaps some of the best information comes forward from those that were in civilian and support roles, non-pensionable people. And they claimed that at back on Shelburne bases that a quarantine was brought about and staff were kept there around the clock. And really trying desperately to figure out what was going on here.
They had, in fact, detected this object that was in the water and differentiated between it and submarines.
Well, like I say, if I looked at the whole aggregate of evidence from people that were saying things outside of the most direct influence or beyond any official release, it does seem there's considerable agreement that there were no radar returns when the thing went in the air. However, under the water, it seems that it could be tracked, and they knew, of course, before they came back the next day that the UFO seen to enter the water of Shag Harbor the night of October 4th was no longer there. Still, of course, they had to go search on site because there was the possibility of debris, unique bottom trauma, whatever. The other thing I think that came into play is the fact that although it was a difficult situation, it kind of played into the authorities' hands in one sense. Somebody realized there was a silver lining to this, that while the world was looking at Shag Harbor and while you had CBC cameras there and press sitting on the shoreline with locals watching the divers the next few days, the real story was out at sea and, of course, eventually off Government Point at Shelburne. This and a second UFO come to rest on the bottom that were detected. This is barely a mile off Government Point near the base. And I think it dawned on some official somewhere, well, let's just let them look here, which they did. There was little attempt to get people away from the shoreline or to create a cover story or anything. Let's have them look at the impact site where things are no longer there, or at least in whole. And the real action was 25 miles away and never saw the public's attention directly at the time.
So what went on 25 miles away?
It appears that the UFO, after submerging, moved under the water and came to rest on the seabed up near the outer harbor area of Shelburne off what's known as McNutt's Island. However, there appears to have been a second UFO on the bottom in the vicinity, and according to stories from the Granby divers, and this was told to me way back in 1993 when I first began to reinvestigate, and they claimed that the two were resting on the bottom, and they sat on ships and dived and looked and took photos, and that this thing was being repaired by another.
Oh, really?
Yes. This is not reflected in the large paper trail that exists. That speaks quite loudly about the attempt by the fleet diving unit of HMCS Granby divers and others of what went on in the Shag Harbor area. And that record also speaks very clearly about their belief that it was probably a UFO event and that it got away. There is nothing official on paper that recognizes the Shelburne story, but it's been told to me, like I say, by the divers of the Granby, by other support staff that worked at the base that were non-pensionable. They insist that this was the case. We have found an RCMP document that refers to the second simultaneous search in the witness statement to another UFO event that night off Sambro, Nova Scotia. It's kind of interesting because in that case, you have a captain of a fishing dragger with 18 men, and they all witnessed four UFOs in the distance on the water surface, and one of them eventually took off and arced toward southwestern Nova Scotia. This is a mere hour and a half before the Shag Harbor incident.
Mm-hmm.
And when they came in, they reported it and filled out an official RCMP report. In the last sentence of the witness's statement, it says, "I'd never seen anything like this before. Perhaps it's like the thing they're looking for down off Shag Harbor or off Shelburne."
Mm.
And when I contacted the captain of the boat, he remembered quite well they were searching there. And the reason he knew is he had passed through it and he'd been warned to stay away on his return that it was a hazard to navigation. So we do have documents that do sort of say that there was, in fact, a second naval operation there that the public didn't know about. They also tried to close Sandy Point Road that went out to the base, but, of course, there were so many local people living on it, I guess it was decided just to let them go home, and few would wander down to the water's edge anyway there because of the lay of the land. But it does appear there was a second simultaneous search, like, say, off the Government Point area, which gives some credence to the story of the Granby divers. But, again, it doesn't jump off the page, but Don and I, of course, tried many other ways to confirm the Shelburne story. I continue to work on it because we were hoping that lighthouse records, which, of course, unfortunately, were missing, and other things, or ship's logs, would flesh out the details.
Missing logs again, huh?
Well, now that takes me up to something I can tell you to bring this up to now, because for me, the Shag Harbor incident is still an active investigation. And there's been some pretty neat little developments in the last couple of years, to say the least. I'm currently working on a new book with local freelance journalist Graham Sims here in Halifax, hoping to complete that this year and find a publisher. Did it before, hope we can do this again. There's already a wealth of new material that gives some considerable new insight into the case. I'll just give you a couple of examples here. You triggered it here when you mentioned the missing records. We had a really interesting occurrence last year. Along with Don and others, I was a presenter down at Shag Harbor in August last summer down there. After that was over, a Coast Guard staffer that's in the area that's well known to the locals dropped by and gave a copy of what was supposedly the actual ship's log from Lifeboat 101 that responded that night to the Shag Harbor incident from the
Clark Fairbairn Life Station. And just before I left that October to do a lecture in Boston, I received an email from Cindy Nickerson, who's head of the Incident Society down there and the postmaster for the community. And she said that Commander Graham Smith had dropped by and has donated to the museum to put on display for some time the actual ship's log that night from 101. And it was interesting for several reasons. One was I'd been sent a copy of that by the East Coast director of the Coast Guard back in 1993. And it had always raised questions because it lacked a lot of detail. There were errors of time in it. It was a controversial thing right from the start. No such problems in the D&D record or RC&P files, but there was a lot of back and forth between me and the Coast Guard. And when I tried to get a future copy of it in the intervening years, it had disappeared, and they weren't able to find it anymore. But I eventually tracked down the Coast Guard personnel that actually wrote the log and had him look at it. And there were a lot of unanswered questions. And there was no real smoking gun here, but it was a fly in the ointment all along, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I did my trip to Boston when I got this thing. When I come back, just before I tucked her email away in a folder, I thought, I better blow open the attachment and take a look at it, just to be sure. And when I did, as soon as I looked at it, I started to laugh. It was totally different from what I'd received in 93. So the first thing I did was I contacted Cindy Nickerson, and I said, Cindy, I want you to take that book and scan the entire book and hang on to it, because I believe the Coast Guard is going to come and take it away tomorrow. Because the next day, as soon as I got up, I called them in the morning, and there was a new executive director in place for the Coast here, and I got this woman on the phone, and my first question was, how many logbooks do your ships have? And, of course, the answer was one. And I said, well, I've already seen two copies for the October records in 1967 for Lifeboat 101. And she went, oops.
Oh, really?
Yes. On her cell phone at a meeting, which they interrupted, and promised me that there would be an investigation and that she would assign an officer to look into it. The next day, I was contacted by Captain Tony Potts, career officer with them, and commanded some of the large icebreakers. And he was at this point in administration down there and had been assigned the case. When I spoke to him on the phone later that morning at Lentz, when he had time, he was the first guy I'd ever dealt with there that seemed completely familiar with the case, which was a bit refreshing. We talked for almost an hour. The conversation ended at 11 a.m. I had sent him an email that had attachment showing the original 93 release from the former administrator, sent him the scans that Cindy sent me of the current book dropped off, and, you know, highlighted the discrepancies, which were huge. And he said, I don't know what it is. I'll get right back to you. And I told him I'd already spoken with the gentleman who'd actually written the records. It wasn't the captain of the boat, but another staffer who was now retired in Newfoundland. I went out that day to do a couple of local radio shows and other things here in Halifax. I got back home at 4 p.m., and when I looked at my computer, I found that just 4 minutes before, there was an email from Captain Potts. And it was very interesting because he said, have been to Shag Harbor. The book is once again in our possession. Normally they take like 30 days to answer. This was fast. As I predicted, they took the book back. He said he looked at it and has been puzzled as to what it all means. He thought that perhaps one was a rough copy and the second was the permanent logbook, but it still wouldn't explain why there were such great discrepancies in the details, the timeline, etc.
Did Cindy Nickerson manage to make a full scan of it? Good.
Yes, she did. So we do have that. What was interesting in the email explanation is he said, I see you have already spoken with the gentleman who made the entries. Really am not sure what this is, not sure which one of them is genuine, but I'm sure this is not an attempt to cover up anything. A word that I'd never used in our discourse. And I have saved that email. It's now a slide in my presentation, of course. And as I say at the end, I'll leave it up to the audience. I'm not sure what it is either, Errol, but apparently Tony's much more sure. I'll leave it to them to decide. That was kind of wild that all these years later, 41 years later, and what would be 15 years after getting that first response, that they have this kind of trouble in their record keeping. And why would you? But it was interesting because the details were, look, in the early version they sent me, they never used the term UFO. Whereas clearly in the Naval and RC&P record, it was a search for a UFO. They openly thought that. You look at some of the military telexes that went between the base and the memorandums that were circulating through defense headquarters, and right on top in the margins they'd write UFO and underline it three times. You know, it was a priority case. But at the Coast Guard, that term's never used. And it's interesting that even mild references had been removed, such as in the newer, what I believe to be genuine log that was donated there. What we see is things like searching for aircraft, and it's got comma, indoor, and a bunch of question marks. That was all removed in the original photocopy they sent me in 93. Just sort of trying to cool it down or whatever. But I like that in his response. He's sure it wasn't an attempt to cover up anything.
No, of course not.
That occurred just last year, and it's hard to believe this late in the game that these things still happen. I have to say that cooperation, the amount of records found from RCMP sources, National Archives, DND's Directorate of History and these things, I found their cooperation and the record keeping all made sense in terms of relating it to like staff interviews and what was known and what had been already been recorded about the case. But there's been an ongoing problem with the Coast Guard record in this, and it still persists, and apparently is still evolving.
It's very telling.
Oh, yes.
That he showed up really, really fast when normally it would take 30 days to retrieve.
That is correct, if not requiring an extension, which they often do. I mean, think about this. The next day, when this problem, let's call it, was actually assigned to Captain Tony Potts, from the moment when I first spoke to him, to this final determination, I guess you would call it, by him, which is actually that he couldn't determine what the reason was and what it all meant. It took, what, 5 hours?
That's amazing.
11 a.m. to 4 p.m. on that day, you know?
And 5 hours is a really long time to try and figure out what the hell happened with their record keeping.
He had sent staff to Shag Harbor and actually retrieved the book from the museum, which I'm sure they've since lost again.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. By the way, we get a copy of that several times over the years from several different administrators. And some of them appear to be making an honest attempt. And then this guy just walks in and donates it to the museum, and it's a complete discrepancy from the original release to me. It's hard to believe this amount of time later that a case like that could be such a hot potato with one government agency, right? But I think it's part of a bigger thing. There's been an ongoing problem at the Coast Guard with record keeping, ships' logs, etc. I think it's something that was systematic, but also, I think, exacerbated by the importance of the case and perhaps their mishandling.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it speaks of all these things. This isn't the kind of smoking gun where you go, aha, they were behind it. You think you have to be very careful about any conclusions. But what is clear is that they're not comfortable with their role in it. They're not comfortable with their history, their response, or how the public sees this thing. I can remember they were quite surprised to find that there were pages dedicated to the Shag Harbor incident, even on the National Archives website, and that it spoke quite strongly about the strength of the incident, that it was perhaps one of Canada's, if not Canada's, most important UFO case. I think they'd just rather not be involved. You see the same kind of embarrassment, for example, in the press with staff to this day at the Halifax Chronicle-Herald that just think that such a distinguished broadsheet should have never run a UFO headline.
Yeah.
It just goes against the grain, Errol, you know
well,
what I mean?
1967, there seemed to be a tacit understanding among media, especially amongst the larger media, that they wouldn't give a lot of credence to UFO reports.
Yeah, and of course, you know, Condon took a kick at the Shag Harbor incident, right? It was one of the 53 case reports looked into, one of the few outside of U.S. territory. But basically, they did not do an on-site investigation. They had a couple conversations on the phone with the top RCMP inspector and Maritime Command and that, and spoke to the watch officer, that kind of thing. But they didn't do an on-site investigation like they did, say, with Michelet.
Yeah, with the Falcon Lake incident out in Manitoba,
where they sent up Roy Craig and a team of investigators. And I think others tagged along. I think, if I remember right, even that Hynek was there. Went to the woods to look at, you know, the smears on the rocks of the radio.
Yeah, he went out with Chris Rutkowski when he was lecturing in Winnipeg.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can tell you, you know, one surprise about the Michelet case, just to mention one thing before we drop that, is that I was surprised, but in 1995, when I was in Ottawa and interviewing people, and I got to interview people like William Bain face-to-face from the air desk, and we talked a little bit about Michelet, and I was surprised, but people with the air desk were actually quite impressed with that, particularly when they looked at the whole thing, like the RCMP trying to get him drunk and trying to get him to recant, and they did their own sort of side investigation into, like, where the radioactive material came from. They thought perhaps he snuck radium out of the hospital or something he'd been at, and They looked into every avenue of it, and he said, no, no, they thought there was something to it. And I was actually kind of surprised. To me personally, though an interesting case, and though Canada's single largest UFO file, the Mitchell case, it doesn't grab me because it's essentially a single witness case, right? But I was surprised how they went on at length, and they were like, no, they did their own little side investigation, and as far as they were concerned, there was something to it. I was very surprised at that admission by them. Of course, I was also surprised that people like Vane admitted to me that he had witnessed UFOs off the coast of Nova Scotia as a pilot on subtrackers, you know? It was an interesting period in our history.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't realize it wasn't like Blue Book at the air desk. In 1967, for example, there were over 200 sightings that had been passed on to them by police and authorities. But they actually did 9 on-site investigations that year, Shag Harbor and Michelet being a couple of them. It wasn't just a filing repository for others. And these men had a good personal interest into it. They were actually sorry to see it, UFO investigations removed from them and given to the NRC, because I don't think they actually did the kind of on-site work the military was doing.
No, certainly the NRC has done nothing, really.
No, they just filed it, and
they
don't
filed
do that
them.
Anymore.
They passed them on to Chris Rutkowski.
Yes. Up until about 1999, this stuff was kept at the Hertzberg Institute there on Sussex Drive, but it's not followed up anymore and for years. See, initially, when it was first handed to them, there were a couple of people there that did do some work personally, but the torch was never passed on as those people retired. People like Professor Tennyson at the University of Toronto and Professor McNeil at Acadia, Nova Scotia, were very interested and did a lot of footwork on their own.
Yeah.
But as these people retired, nobody ever filled their shoes, and it just became a filing system. And then eventually that evaporated. And I think was officially disbanded in 1999 from a letter they sent me.
It's really unfortunate that, as you say, there weren't people who were successors.
And not only that, but their records, their personal work has disappeared even. In the case of McNeil, I spent a few years trying to track down what happened to his paperwork and files. Often these academics, as they pass on, they're often, they bequeath their work to the university or somewhere. But it appears that all of his work done with the NRC was shredded by a jealous colleague he worked with at the university. There was actually a little court investigation to it, and I spoke with the judge and others, and his work had never been found. And it's unfortunate because the few letters, as you see within Records Group 77 at National Archives, show quite well what this gentleman's commitment was and the amount of personal investigation he did. But the bulk of it is missing for now.
There have been, through ufological history, the modern history of the field, there have been several wives who, when their husbands passed, tossed everything into the dumpster.
Yes. I can give you another interesting case of that. One of the fellows who was the scientific consultant to Maritime Command who looked into the Shag Harbor incident was coordinated was a Dr. Maurice, better known as Mace Coffey. And I was able to find a lot of his other work in Ottawa at the Directorate of History, but I couldn't find any of his direct reports on the Shag Harbor incident.
Hmm.
But it actually allowed me to sort of forensically reconstruct, and in this book I'm working on, a lot of his search techniques and what his view was of the phenomena. But the work that we did find has actually been republished and sits in the reading room in Ottawa on Colonel By Drive that the military keeps. And they were quite interested in his work and heritage and have made that available again at some point in the future, maybe online. But it kind of creeps you out. It makes you realize how much has been missing. Because when I looked at this guy's material, like it was brilliant work. You know, it actually says in an APRO document we have here where somebody was interviewing the spokesman at Maritime Command. They said, look, if any artifacts or anything of extreme interest is found, it'll be turned over to Mr. Mace Coffey at Maritime Command, who also works on the Defense Research Board. And yet his actual reports on Shag Harbor have not been found. This guy went on to do a wealth of work in the high Arctic, and he was an expert in underwater search. He actually designed programs for the RAND Corporation and other think tanks. He's rather an unknown. I hope to make him better known with the next book in Canadian history's contribution. But his ideas on UFOs are probably as significant as Wilbur Smith's and others, perhaps more so. And I hope to really give him some space in the book, for example. But it's a shame, like you say, when you think about what wives, jealous colleagues, others have shredded, it's a sad legacy in our history. Hopefully we can regain even more from other sources, right? But that fiasco I was telling you about with the Coast Guard and their record keeping, there's something even more recent, Errol, that's come up that really shed some light on Che Guevara. That's another example of, I love to say when I'm presenting on stage, that one of the things that keeps me going is sometimes you don't find what you're looking for, but you find something better.
Yeah.
And we have another good example of that recently. You mentioned some of the documentaries I've been involved with others like Don and Michael McDonald, right? You know, the Shank Harper incident, Canada's Roswell, Northern Lights, etc., right?
Mm-hmm.
In many of those, one of the things that's been reattached to Shag Harbor incident and the night of the UFOs was the flight of Air Canada Flight 305. And that was something over the years I never quite felt solid or good about, which is why in many of my MUFON research papers that coincide with presentations I did at the international symposiums and that,
yes,
I had never included it. There was one paper in particular that early on, I was fully aware of Flight 305, and it mentions many of the other possibly connected incidents from October 4th, 67. And I didn't include that because, it, first of all, it just didn't make sense. It was so far away geographically over St. Jean, Quebec. The kind of lights and things seen bore no similarity to Shag Harbor, removed in the timeline. I just didn't see the connection. The other thing is I knew even then there were other possibilities that what was seen perhaps had a more conventional explanation. And we now know what that is, and Don agrees with me. And in fact, in August, when he and I were both presenting, I brought up the fact that I no longer consider Flight 305's observations to be a UFO event, and I have contacted the pilots of the flight, and they agree with me. They think now that what they saw was a rocket that had been fired off from Wallops Island and had expelled noble gas into the high atmosphere. And it put on a very impressive display that night. In fact, when they radioed the airport in Montreal, they asked if New York was still there. They thought it was nuclear war, seeing the explosions and, you know, the bright lights in the sky. But again, when we look at the firing time and the direction they were looking in and all the other factors, it seemed very clear that what they saw was that. I felt kind of good about it in that, and I announced on the stage that all these other things, the Sambro sighting, the story from the divers about Shelburne, were sound, but that I didn't consider these events over there connected with in any way. And in fact, I now believe that that part of the UFO story is an IFO, right? Well, some people told me, like, well, that's too bad because now you've got it in the air locally at low altitude and it's on the water and under the water, but you don't have this thing coming in from the atmosphere at 30,000 feet. And I said, well, look, you can't pick and choose your data. I personally can back up and show where I never thought this should have actually been connected to the case. 2 months later, I got an email from Stanton Friedman saying that some local MUFON investigators had filmed an interview, a pilot that had a UFO sighting down in Pennsylvania at his summer home. And during the interview, they realized that it was probably part of the Shag Harbor incident. So I got in touch with the pilot, a gentleman by the name of Ralph Lowinger, who was retired, a career Pan Am pilot of cargo flights. And it was very clear early on in talking to him that what he's seen was very much connected to the case, in that he believed that he had flown over that night on a flight that was going from Kennedy Airport to Heathrow, and that at 33,000 feet, about 100 to 50 miles out from the Gulf of Maine, about to fly over Shag Harbor, they had a UFO drop down in front of the nose of the aircraft. And at one point, they were within half a mile of it, and came out of autopilot, quite worried about collision. And the description of the UFO was very much the same as what was seen in Shag Harbor, 60 feet across, four flashing lights. So anyway, I interviewed this gentleman, and he had all the hard details. He had saved his rough log notes from all his flying career, and when we looked it up, he had the, like, block departure time from the airport, the altitude, direction, all the hard details, tail number of the aircraft. The pilot was now deceased, but the flight engineer was still alive and was a personal friend of his. They're all, of course, retired now. I eventually tracked this fellow down in Colorado and interviewed him. His memory was a little better, and the details from this were extremely interesting. He describes the tension in the aircraft. He also remembered that they actually had a second flight crew on board that was dead heading back to Britain, and he woke them up, and they all came in the cockpit. So you had six pilots up there watching this. And all those who were alive, there were five of them, have agreed to have their names used. They stood by the details. Perhaps the most interesting observation of all is that when they were within the half-mile distance and grabbed the yoke to come out of autopilot, the flight engineer went up sort of cupping his hands around his eyes to the windshield, and he was puzzled, as they all said, by just the nature of the light, the quality of it. These lights didn't look like normal nav lights you're looking at. And when he cupped his eyes and looked, he realized, he said, that the lights were not external, but he was looking into it.
Ooh.
Yeah. He said that really just gave him this fearful feeling in his thing, and there was quite a discourse. The dialogue was quite strong between him and the main pilot, saying, look, we have got to move. We're just too close. If something flies off this thing or happens, we're screwed. This is not good. All through this, there was radio contact with Logan, and of course, they weren't painting anything or showing anything on the radar, and the aircraft in the air had no returns on theirs either. But he said there was definitely this solid craft in front of us. As they come out, about to come out of autopilot, the thing starts putting some distance between them, up to the point of being about maybe 3 miles ahead of their nose, and then it just angled up and shot up at a 45-degree angle. And they crouched down and looked up, and they estimated it took about 10 seconds to, as he describes, leave the atmosphere. So it definitely wasn't anything conventional. And this was just hours before the Sag Harbor incident in the area. Logan Airport asked, before they were handed off to Moncton Center, they were at that point over the Gulf of Maine, if they wanted to follow the UFO report, and the captain said no. But as he said, the flight crew woke up, never went back to sleep, and they stayed awake all the way across the ocean to Heathrow talking about this, and none of them ever forgot it. So anyway, the story of that is new to us, definitely connects with the Sag Harbor incident. There'll be one of the many new things we have, hopefully, in the new book. Again, just serves to strengthen the case, both in terms of its unconventional nature and in terms of its high credibility. But it's not every day you get to use the pilots' names and you have all those great details. It ties in with that early April preliminary report I mentioned earlier about the Coast Guard, and it's interesting in that when they were in the air, Logan says, no, there's no traffic ahead of you. 40 miles behind you, we're showing a SAC refueling mission at lower altitude. Well, we have a record of that flight. It all connects so well, you know. So that was a great find. But up until Stanton sent me that email, until I interviewed these people, this is just a couple months ago, we never knew about the observations. Again, it just goes on. Like I say, you lose something, you gain something better. Mind you, there's not too much we've ever lost in this case, except things that shouldn't have been connected in the first place. But when that happens, I'll tell you, I'm just amazed at how this case hangs together.
It certainly, with the ongoing appearance of more evidence, makes it what was a fairly solid case to begin with, even more so.
Well, that's right. And what I like about the observations of these pilots is they not only strengthen the fact that there was all this UFO activity in that week, in that month around southwestern Nova Scotia, but they're the kind of observations that preclude conventional explanation, the flight characteristics of what they've seen. And again, you know, five pilots, you know, communicating with ground control and making these very close-up observations, I mean, it doesn't get much better than that.
It doesn't, does it?
No, no. And I'll tell you something, Earl, what makes this live for me is that when I was interviewing the flight engineer, the second fellow that remembered the other flight crew and their names, you could still hear the tension in his voice. You knew this thing had affected him. He was the young fellow on board at the time, the most junior officer. He described actually putting his hand on the shoulder and saying, Kurt, to the pilot, like, we got to come out of autopilot. We're too damn close. You know, this kind of tension, him saying, look, I'll admit it, I was just scared. You know, this was going to go bad. You know, on a night, like he said, when the visibility was so good, they could see fishing boats 100 miles away from their altitude, herring seiners and that, with the lights on the water.
Yeah.
So it was like being there in the cockpit with him. I know when he first told me this, I've been looking into this thing since 1992, and I love it when I still get that tingle on my spine, you know? And I'm sitting there, and I'm writing down the details furiously and going, yes. Yeah, that's what I want, the good stuff, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I get it. Like I say, the case is still an active investigation. It still surprises me that it is, and then you can find this type of quality detail, but it's there. And, of course, it always makes me lie there at night and stare at the ceiling before I go to sleep and wonder, what have I missed? What else is there? You know there's more.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, there has to be more.
And I trust that that more will show up in the next months before you put the book to bed.
Well, this is where doing things like this with you actually do help, and I really mean this. And I'm sure a lot of people out there probably think we do this because we're all a little bit of a ham, and it's the Rod Steiger in us. We like the sound of our own voice, right? But the fact that the case had been in the media, that you know, that we've done these TV specials and podcasts and radio shows and whatever, you know, that kind of general knowledge that leaks out helps bring witnesses like that forward. and to tell somebody, and it helps those somebodies forward it on to people like myself that can make use of it and do it, you know, in a more in-depth look, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So these things do have merit. And I always make a point of asking when witnesses bring forward information. And sometimes they say, oh, it was your book. Oh, we saw a rerun on TV. It was a podcast my son downloaded. You know what I mean? But all of these things do serve a purpose, mm-hmm. and do actually help, you know, the nuts and bolts type investigation and to tie these things down. So I always try to make time for them. I just say to the people out there that they serve that purpose. It's not just to flex an ego or, you know, to hear the sound of our voice. But in their small way, they've been an important part of this ongoing developing story that is Shag Harbor, and I'm sure in many other UFO investigations, you know.
Yeah.
The media has been helpful. You know, the record and spreading the word has been helpful, and people do come forward. At the same time, there are those who come forward that just want to, you know, get their name in there too. But that quickly becomes evident, and, you know, the good stuff, the cream quickly floats to the top, and you get noticed, you know. But,
well, it's good to know the cream is still flowing to the
yeah,
top.
It is.
On the Shag Harbor incident.
Sometimes I have to pinch myself when you hear that, you know, that stuff. But, you know, when the hard details start coming in, you know, very early on when you make these calls, Errol, you know, whether somebody is just, you know, making a stretch to be inclusive and part of this thing, or whether somebody, you know, really has the good stuff. And when they have the right answers and they come quickly and they can back it up, you know, wow, you know. It's good stuff, you know.
Chris, I'm looking forward to seeing the book when it comes out. And
yeah, I can't really tell you when that'll be.
No,
but there will be one.
Yes, and there needs to be one, obviously.
I remember barking with Don about Dark Objects. I think it took us about 3 years to get it out from the point we ended the manuscript. You know, publishing is rough, you know.
Yeah.
And
Especially
selling Canadian UFO stories in the U.S. and abroad is a big challenge, but hey, we did it before, you know, and I'm sure we get, and the thing is, and there's enough new research and enough interesting things, like the two little stories I told you today.
I'm sure there's more. Yeah, I'm sure there's more,
you know,
too. Yeah,
it's not just a rehash of Dark Object or previous research. And I don't know where to lead, because it's still going as we're wrestling with the manuscript here and the many rewrites, you know.
Well, I guess we'll find out over the coming months if there's anything startling. Please let us know. We'll have you back on.
Well, I'll bear you in mind. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. You've been a great help over the years. And like I say, I just like to remind your audience that I'm not even sure that's the correct term anymore. I'm kind of a dinosaur technologically.
The listener, yeah.
Yeah, but I believe these things are important. And, you know, anything that gets out there and helps, you know, we need to take advantage of everything and leave no stone unturned, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like I remind everybody, consider getting out of that armchair, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, I use Google too, but I mean, there's nothing like knocking on the door, pressing the flesh, or hearing that voice of that first real good hard detail, you know?
Yeah, that's something we grumble about a lot on this program, is the people that are happy reading UFO updates or various other lists, and that's the extent of their research.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes, like, I think there's a big difference between even the phone here that I hold in my hand and the thing, because, you know, sometimes on the text you don't hear that tone of voice, which will lead to the next question.
Uh-huh.
I know that I've achieved things in phone interviews I could not have done texting online. I know there were things that I've done face-to-face, you know, trying to, you know, get somebody's eye contact that I couldn't get. It tells me so much more than I would have got either of those other two ways, you know. There's nothing like being there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nothing like being there.
And there's nothing like having you here, Chris Stiles. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you for your interest.
We'll talk to you soon, Chris Stiles. Thank you.
Okay, once again, thanks, Errol. It's been a pleasure.
Every year around this time, Jeff Dipman and Chris Rutkowski publish the annual Canadian UFO Survey. 2008 came and went. February has just about came and went, and on the line with us to discuss last year's numbers in the Canadian UFO survey is Chris Rutkowski. Welcome back to the program, Chris.
Thank you very much, Errol. Nice to be here.
Much anticipation about this year's survey. I know what the results were because you posted the press release last week, the end of last week, and whammo, it's all over the place.
Yes, indeed. It's been picked up, which is good because we need to get the word out more and more. This is a remarkable year because in 2008, there were more than 1,000 UFO reports noted across Canada, which is up significantly, more than 25%. The media say 25%, but it's actually closer to 26%, and 25% over the year before. And that's a significant number. We're getting close to 3 per day, and that's quite a few reports from coast to coast.
It is, when you consider the number of reports you've had over the years since the inception of the survey. Are you still getting lots of stuff from the Canadian government as the official reporting person?
I wouldn't say lots of stuff. Every week, maybe one or two cross my desk. The real big number of reports come from other sources, places that are online, for example, web pages like Houston, B.C., like Peter Davenport's National UFO Reporting Center. Those types of places get many hundreds every year. And, you know, we really comb everywhere we can find. We scour the waterfront and so forth. We go to websites. We look at other UFO reporting sites. We go to UFO groups. We go to National Defense Department of Transport. Things that come directly to us. We even gone to YouTube for the first year this time round and found a whole passel of UFO sightings and videos that are thrown up there from Canada for 2008. So we really have a good snapshot of what's been reported in Canada in 2008.
So because you're going to more places to find these reports, does that mean that the bump of close to 26% has been caused by that, or do you think more people are reporting?
No, the 25% cannot be attributable only to the fact we're really scouring. We've scoured before. YouTube, we only got about a dozen or two from there, so that's simply not enough to put us over the top. No, I think people are aware that there are places to report, so people are filing the reports more and more in greater numbers, and I think that's what's contributing to it.
Ontario, for quite a while, was the leading province or territory in Canada as far as UFO reports. Has there been any change?
No, as a matter of fact, once again, 2008, they had the most UFO reports for the year, 334, up a little bit from 329 from the year before, and it's an all-time high for Ontario, incidentally. And that actually puts the number that we've collected for all of Ontario over the past 20 years to more than 2,200, still not matching the 2,500 from BC that have been collected over the years. So, but you're gaining. Ontario is, in fact, gaining on BC.
I don't know why. I was under the impression that perhaps Alberta had come out on top as far as number of reports in 2008.
They're up. They're certainly at the highest they've ever been as well. But no, Ontario is still the highest number of reports, followed by BC and Alberta. In fact, Alberta was higher than Quebec, which is a bit of an anomaly.
Well, I guess that'll teach me to believe everything I read in the newspapers.
Yeah, the newspapers also said that I suggested that many UFO reports were aircraft and towers, which is not true. I believe it's perhaps my mumbling that resulted in saying some of the possible explanations for UFO reports are airplanes, TARs, and other things. And that was interpreted as towers. So there are some minor little problems with media reporting of the story, but other than that, the point is that there are a lot of UFO reports.
So you got 1,004 reports. That doesn't mean 1,004 unidentified flying objects.
No, no. In fact, we do break them down by evaluation. As a matter of fact, just looking at the numbers here, there were 99 unexplained, so just under 10% were unexplained.
And how does that 10% compare to other years?
actually it's a little bit lower. The percentage of unexplained tends to vary. It's been as low as 8.5% and as high as about 18. So 10 is sort of somewhere in the middle there, so we're just about where things usually are.
And how many of those 1,004 reports are just out-and-out stupidity as far as observation is concerned?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily use the term that specifically.
All right, naivete.
Naivete. I was very surprised, and it takes a lot to surprise me these days, but in reviewing, I actually sat and looked at each and every one of these 1,004 reports, and I was very surprised to find out how many of those reports were stars and planets. In fact, I actually corresponded with some of the witnesses, insisting to me that they were not looking at stars and planets, and yet I would say things like, well, but Venus is in precisely the same location in the sky as you're reporting this stationary spacecraft that you've been reporting every night for the past 2 weeks, and it hangs in the sky for 3 to 4 hours, and you don't say that Venus is anywhere else in the sky, so that's Venus. And people are just astounded at the fact that I refuse to believe that the bright object sitting in the sky for hours and hours is not an interstellar spacecraft. And it gets further complicated when they have video and photos of this object, and they say, but look, this isn't a star. What it looks to be like a mottled dish round object with craters and portholes and things like that. And what happens is that your camera or video camera is racking out trying to focus on a star that's effectively at infinity, and it's just simply unfocusing and just turning into this little fuzzy spherical thing that really doesn't give you any information whatsoever.
There seems to be a lot of that, either camera artifacts or misidentifications of Venus, etc., etc.
It's puzzling to me why people would assume that these objects are spacecraft instead of relatively ordinary astronomical objects, although there are several that really make me puzzled by this. I mean, there are some reports where these stationary objects would suddenly dart across the sky from horizon to horizon, and Venus, not in the habit of doing that, make me wonder what the heck these people were seeing. So there are some interesting variations on this, and those are the ones that we tend to say, well, we're not sure what they are. For the most part, though, we do have a very large proportion of possible or probable explanation cases. That doesn't mean that they're completely ruled out, but they just simply seem to be something a little more prosaic than claiming to be unexplained.
Which, I guess, leads us neatly to the most interesting inexplicables.
Yes, the strangest of the strange. That doesn't actually refer to you and I, but it has actually...
Oh, I'm insulted. I want to be strangest of the strange.
But there were a few interesting cases. We whittled them down to a little under 1% that were what we called high-quality unexplained cases. And the qualifications are that the reports had a reliability rating of 7 or greater, and that rating system is sort of an arbitrary 1 to 9, where the reliability of an anonymous phone call in the middle of the night by someone who may be a bit inebriated, maybe like a 1, to a 9, where a 9 is investigated thoroughly by RCMP or a major investigation group, plus there's photographs, plus the witnesses are completely cooperative, plus there are diagrams, etc. So somewhere between those two ranges, and a 7 means it's fairly high. Strangeness rating of 6 or greater, and strangeness similarly in a 1 is simply a light seen in the sky, not doing much of anything perhaps, maybe bouncing around would make it a 2 or a 3, where an 8 or a 9 is a landing of a spacecraft in someone's backyard and probably on their toes. A 6 means fairly unusual in some extent. And even beyond that, we also have to assign the case an evaluation of unknown. You could have a 7 and a 6 and then still have a good idea of what was reported in the case of Fireball, for example, that crashed to the ground, such as happened in Alberta last fall. So you have to be unknown, a high strangeness, high reliability cases, and of those, there were 7 that fit some of the qualifications.
Of those 7, were any above 6?
Yes.
Oh.
In fact, fascinating one. This one was reported in the news. Came through our friend Barb Campbell at the Saskatchewan Paranormal Phenomena Research Center. Actually, she's handed it over to somebody else at this point, but at that time she was investigating. This was March 11th, 2008, around 7:30 in the evening in Wadena, Saskatchewan. A couple were driving on a highway, still fairly light out, when the car in front of them suddenly braked, and so they were forced to put on their brakes suddenly. And as they did this, a metallic gray object zoomed across the highway at car level in front of the car in front of them. And they said it was oblong, sort of Volkswagen Beetle-ish in shape, and zoomed right across the highway and disappeared on the other side of the highway. And, of course, there was no crossroad at that point, no indication of tracks. They reported it to the RCMP. This was investigated by Barb Campbell herself. Witnesses were very cooperative, seemed very, very sincere, drew a nice sketch of what had occurred. A puzzling incident, and that rated one of our most interesting Canadian unknowns in 2008.
Did the people in the second car actually stop along with the people in the first car and discuss what they saw?
Apparently, no. The first car had braked and screeched to a halt, and then as soon as the object was gone, zoomed away. So I can imagine somebody was perhaps freaked out by almost hitting a flying saucer. Those darn aliens flying too low all the time. You know.
Yeah. I could understand them being freaked out. But wouldn't you look in your rearview mirror and see, oh, let's talk to those people because they would verify what it was that we saw?
One would think that's part of the mystery.
So that was Wadena, Saskatchewan. What strangeness level did you assign that?
That was a strangeness of 7 and a reliability of an 8.
Fairly high numbers on that.
Fairly high numbers on that, yeah.
Was that the highest strangeness, highest reliability case from last
year? Actually, it was. It had the highest rating of any case last year.
Any others that made you arch your eyebrows, as you are oft wont to do?
Yes. Well, a couple that were a little bit puzzling. A case in Newfoundland, July 20th, Corner Brook, 11:45 in the evening. Three people, actually a father and his two sons, were along the coast. And they saw an object that they described as an X or a cross. It had four wings with a central core with lights along each of the four wings flying directly over them. It flew northeast, banked, and then flew northwest and out across the ocean. Very unusual. The sketch that they provided was quite illustrative of something rather odd. Really nice sighting. Unfortunately, even though I assigned this a fairly high level, I think it was a 6 or a 7 or something like that, we don't have information on whether it was investigated adequately. This was reported to an online website, and of course, you know, some of the webmasters of these places are many thousands of miles away from where the sighting took place, so it's unlikely it was ever investigated in person or referred to anybody in Newfoundland, for example. I tried contacting some newspapers and radio stations in Newfoundland, but they hadn't heard of this. Of course, it hadn't been reported officially and didn't make any news out there. So what bumped this down a little bit is because there was no on-site investigation, which is actually the case for many of the reports this year. Because there were so many that were reported to online websites, on the one hand, it's very wonderful that there are such outlets for people to make their reports, but because the reports aren't actually not passed along to local investigators, there's no way of doing an intense enough investigation to really allow us to get a good idea of what was seen and perhaps come up with some possible explanations or, in fact, rule out possible explanations. So that's one of the drawbacks. And yet, despite the fact of that, the detail of the statement from the witnesses and the drawing which was produced and the fact that we know that they had been in correspondence at least with the webmaster of a website made this a very unusual case and put it as one of the more interesting ones for 2008.
With tongue in cheek, I say it sounds more like a religious experience. A flying cross.
Indeed.
You're an astronomer, and it suddenly occurs to me, I was talking with my brother the other day, and he asked me what the brightest object in the sky was at night. And I pointed to Venus. And, of course, there is the moon. But he maintains now, with all the solar arrays on the International Space Station, that that's much brighter than anything else. And not having seen it lately, I call upon your expertise as an astronomer.
Let's see. Venus clocks in at about a -2 in magnitude. The space station will, I suppose, rival Venus from time to time, depending on the orientation. I suppose we could say Venus is the brightest astronomical object in the sky. The space station will occasionally pass overhead and will be moving at a fairly good clip compared to the stationary object that Venus will appear. Actually, Venus is starting to disappear from our skies. It's quite low now in the west, but Saturn is now starting to be quite bright, and it's coming up in the east. Yes, the space station is visible to a certain extent, but so are a lot of other brilliant satellites. In fact, several of the reports that we got, in fact, not several, literally hundreds of reports last year were certainly of satellites moving across the sky. We have reports of people sitting in their backyard hot tubs in the middle of summer looking up and seeing star-like objects moving across the sky slowly and ponderously, sometimes joined by two or three others. Those tend to be satellites, and depending on whether they give enough accurate times and things like that and directions, we might be able to find out whether those were some of the more prominent satellites moving through the sky.
I've seen the International Space Station, I guess, three or four times now, and it always struck me as being relatively faint, a sort of soft blue fuzzy light moving extremely quickly across the sky.
Yeah, it tends to really zip, but from time to time, depending on the orientation, it can appear fairly bright.
Well, thank you for settling that for me.
Yes.
I shall play this recording back to my brother now and say, see? We were both right. This survey, the 2008 Canadian UFO survey, is it online yet, or is it in the throes of being put online?
No, it is completely viewable. One can get to it very easily by going to survey.canadianuforeport.com without any of those silly W's at the beginning. So simply survey.canadianuforeport.com. And if anyone's listening who has a report from Canada, for 2009, as we're already well into the year, and there's already quite a few reports that we're getting for this year, you can send it to CanadianUFOReport@hotmail.com.
Good. Did you see that Globe and Mail article?
Yes.
that combined both you and the former Canadian Minister of Defense, Paul Hellyer?
Yes. Yeah, I saw that. Interesting mix of stories, but it was an editorial after all, so... We did actually get some fairly good coverage on this, and which it's actually quite good. In fact, reading the Globe and Mail online edition, you get some of the comments left by people, and actually CBC has a similar sort of thing. And the one thing that impresses me is the fact that most of the people posting comments have not read the survey at all. It's simply gut reaction, and so there's a lot of skeptics saying, oh, what a ridiculous article. Everybody knows that there's no such thing as UFOs. When in fact the survey is very clear that this is what people in Canada actually are reporting. So the UFO reports actually exist. They are reports of unidentified flying objects. And the reports come from laypersons, civilians, as well as military officers. So the closed-mindedness of skeptics really comes through when you look at the comments left on some of the websites.
Oh, yeah, I've noticed that a lot. Various blogs, various websites. There's just total lack of indifference as far as actually looking at things and investigating, even cursory research.
Yeah, and one of the reasons we do this survey is for educational purposes, for the general public. We do get compliments from scientists from time to time saying, this is very interesting, I hadn't realized there were so many reports, I hadn't realized that the characteristics are thus, thus, and thus, and it's very interesting, thank you very much. So the data and the survey itself are available online for anyone to use, and it's really indicative and illustrative of what people in Canada really are seeing, and you can certainly extrapolate to other countries. There isn't a comparable study for the United States. There are similar studies in a few other countries around the world. Sweden comes to mind, Italy, Spain to a lesser extent, where they collect not only the civilian UFO reports, but also some military reports that have been released. So it's very interesting to see that our study is probably the most rigorous of any that's done around the world. And it really is just the facts, ma'am. This is what people really are seeing. This is what the fuss is all about. And to some people, it's not quite as interesting as Build, and some people find it much more interesting.
Those surveys go back many years now. What, 20 years, you said?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, a little bit later this year, probably summer-ish, we're going to put out our 20-year longitudinal study of Canadian UFO reports. How have things changed over the years, and what are the more interesting cases that have been found?
And your book, you're author of several books, but the most recent one was the Canadian UFO Report.
No, actually, A World of UFOs is the most recent.
Well, slap me upside down the head.
World of UFOs is out now in fine bookstores everywhere, published by Dundurn Press. That goes beyond the Canadian UFO Report. Canadian UFO Report, with Jeff Dittman, just sort of looked at Canada. World of UFOs is detailing some of the more interesting cases to the four corners of the globe.
Oh, that sounds like a wonderful read.
Yes.
Look forward to having a look at that one.
Yes.
Now you're going to disappear off the scene for a few weeks, I understand.
Yes. I'm busying myself with a number of other projects. Do some work on a paper that I'm presenting at the MUFON Symposium in August, which is due in April. Also, I have another book project that just been handed me, a book about UFOs for kids. So I've got enough to keep me busy for a while. So I think I'll fade away and let the ufologists battle this out for a while. But I'll be lurking. I will be lurking.
Yes, as only you can lurk, Chris Rutkowski. That website again is
survey.canadianuforeport.com.
Chris, as always, thank you for your work. You're one of the people that works away very quietly in the background and pops up every year along with, well, not along with Jeff Dittman, because Jeff Dittman seldom pops up, but his name does come up every year.
Yes, he's a big part of what goes on. There's a number of people behind the scenes, and mm-hmm. he is certainly the one who really is probably one of the most diligent, hardworking ufologists in the world today, and yet nobody's heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
Great kudos to him.
We and the listener have heard of him, and if not in the past, certainly this time for the first time. Always good talking with you, and
yeah.
I look forward to going to your website and having a good, long, hard look at the results of the 2008 Canadian UFO survey.
Indeed, and good talking with you again too, Errol.
We will talk to you, I bet you when the 20-year comes out in the summertime.
It's a date.
I love long-term dates. Bye, Chris. Thank you, sir.
Bye.
Bye. That's SDI-467. And who says that UFOs aren't real? Well, and if UFOs aren't real, then what is the mystery that surrounds UFOs. And this program will be back next time with more ufological interestings and things to make you go, what? Till next time.
This edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli.
Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.